allegiance, please, sir.
Okay, do it again. Everybody stand, take the flag, open up our heart, ready to begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please, sir.
Director Altamirano. Vice President Leja.
Here.
Director Scarbello.
Here.
President Chabas.
Here.
Director Murphy.
Here.
Nobody in the waiting room?
There's nobody currently in the waiting room.
Nobody there. Do we have any items for discussion on the consent calendar? Anybody ask questions?
I'm going to move for approval of the minutes and salary expense.
I'll second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Correspondence and related information?
Nothing is included in tonight's board packet.
Reports, operations reports.
A and B, there's nothing.
Emergency, okay, guys. General manager and staff reports.
The only update I have is city related, so not this Saturday, but the following Saturday. It'll be the last time I can remind you guys is the City of Poopa Valley, the Public Works, the open house at JVOP over there. We are signed up to go, so we will be participating like we've done the last couple of years. I guess this is the second year. So
when is it?
Saturday, May 10th at 8 a.m. I think it goes 8 to 12. I'm not sure. Do you know who staff is going to be there?
All the staff. Our staff? Yeah. Marco Anthony.
Oh,
if you didn't look at their flyer for this year, though, there were kids in that picture, in that flyer with our, like, little plastic.
Yeah,
their sticker.
And that's it. Well, Director Scarbello and I went to the Cal Fire Demonstration Expo. I had mentioned it at the last board meeting. We do have some pictures. Melissa's not here today, so, and we already have a long agenda, so we'll pop those open on the 15th. And then we had the mayor's pancake breakfast today, or prayer pancake breakfast today, so that was good, well-attended event. So that's all I have.
They had a helicopter.
Okay, committee reports. Prior to the budget meeting last week, we had a trash committee, and then we met again after the budget meeting. There are four items. One is on the agenda for today. That's the adjustment of rates. The other three items are we need to verify contract compliance. There's the street sweeping call out that's still at issue. And then what came up at the last meeting was signed. I was unaware that there were signs on poles that had street sweeping. So I took a photograph. This is the sample of one.
Yeah, I sent some of those to Brian.
So, let me pass it down. We want people to know when the streets are swept. We can post it on our website. That's not a big deal. We can include it in a flyer or a mailer. That's not a big deal. And we can do these signs. The individual cost is going to run in the hundreds, and there's hundreds of signs, so that's something we have to get budgeted. The thing I wanted to highlight was when we're talking about street sweeping, there's an issue with using the fire hydrants to recharge the water amount in the water tank in the sweeper. So I ran some numbers. We're increasing the number of sweepers from 1 to 2. So that's twice per day to refill the thing, because we got to refill that water tank 4 times. It's 5 days a week, and they sweep 4 weeks out of the year. From the middle of our district to their yard is 5 miles. 10 miles round trip. The time on that, according to the 12 minutes each way, so that's 24 minutes. That's 800 fewer miles driven, 4 less man days, just driving back and forth. So that would reduce their total energy consumption, which is likely going to be an internal combustion engine, making it more carbon, reducing the carbon footprint. It's going to allow more time to be cleaning the streets. and it's out of cost. They're getting water out of our meters, and we can either have them carry meters or just withdraw it. And that's estimated at 2 units of water per day. That's 28 units per month. That varies from $75 to $100 because it's a long contract term. That's the reason for having the street sweepers refill from our meters. But it's a unmetered usage. And because it's an unmetered usage, it would be comparable to these jumpers that we put in, or you could account for it as a distribution, like when we wash hydrants. So that's the reason for that.
How do they do it now for the rest?
So normally what is done is at the start of the day, they fill their tanks and empty the hopper. Then they go out and they sweep at the yard. So they're a business like any other business. They have a meter, and they have some place to dump their waste, like the waste transfer facility. So they go out and they apply water and sweep up whatever's in the street. And the amount of water they apply is constant, but the amount of material they sweep up varies. Some days it's going to be more than less. So the question is, do you want this street sweeper pulling off of sweeping the street to drive across town to get more water? Because they got to drive across town to dump their load. So based on the size of the hopper and the size of the water tank and the application rate, I estimate that it would allow them to refill their water tank from our hydrants. They'll be going back to the yard twice per day as opposed to four times per day.
Questions?
Yeah,
I'm
sorry.
Yeah, I on the sign,
yeah.
Are you saying that's our responsibility?
So we're responsible for the street sweeping, and we have, then there's signage up that is the street sweeping sign. I've looked at, I had not, 2 weeks ago, I hadn't noticed them.
Oh, I think
probably because they're mostly blank now.
Right. And I think we discussed these at a previous meeting, and we were told that the city provided those signs. They do.
Yes, currently street sweeping is under the city, but that will change here shortly. Street sweeping will fall under our contract, thus making it our responsibility.
So the signs will then become our
reason. Yeah, I saw Paul Tor this morning at the pancake breakfast. I'm like, do you guys have like a database or a log of where all these signs exist? And they're looking into it because that would alleviate having to send our staff to figure out where all these signs are at. Because we do want to have accurate current signage that's legible and not faded.
And generally, if you look at how they're posted, they're generally posted when you come into a neighborhood. Either way that you come into, it's only like say.
They're mounted to existing light poles, right? So they're not
right.
Like the
so, yeah, it's not like we got to go put.
Yeah.
It's not like we got to go put poles.
So it is possible. If you look at that image, you'll see that there's a sticker on it, and then there's another sticker on the sticker. It is possible to take the existing sign and relaminate it.
Exactly.
The main cost there is the labor, and the thing that drives it is there are lots of signs. There may be two or four per neighborhood. The neighborhood's about 8 or 10 blocks. So you're looking at something on the order of several hundred signs for several hundred dollars.
I don't know. We'll get a figure out.
Yeah, I'm looking into it. I don't think we can just pull these signs off and relaminate it because it's going to be first and third Thursday of every month or second.
Yeah,
and
I think that's probably why they're done the way they're done, so they can change the days because street sweeping days do change. You know, I mean, according to the
they're right. They do.
The stickers would indicate that they have changed multiple times.
Oh, that's just a sticker.
So, my guess is that most of the signs are faded.
They are. I mean, I sent you the photos of one in my neighborhood. They look just like that.
Exactly like that.
So,
I thought maybe it was the same picture.
Yeah, I know.
No.
But yeah, it's, and it was pretty shocking for me to see because I saw the one in the coming into the track and I've never noticed that one because it was so faded. But it was one I just can't miss. End of the track. And that encompasses a big area where I live.
Yeah. So we're looking.
That's two signs for a big area.
So we're looking into this. I mean, I think if all goes well in this contract and it's affected by July 1, we can definitely do outreach, have stuff on their website, social media, to have a more current, street sweeping map, and then this will take some time to
fix.
Now, the question, Murphy, was do we want them to tap into our water or let them go back to
the... So the plan is to have them get water from our hydrants. It just needs water so that they're less driving and more hours available to so what we currently do is we have this, most water is metered. Some meters are accurate. Like my water meter hasn't read any usage. But some district usage is unmetered, like fire hydrant flushing. Some private usage, like new development, the stingers, that's unmetered. You have to quantify on your report. Annually, you have to report how much water you took out of the ground. You have to report how much water was sold. That's part of the, that is a regulatory requirement. It's different than a regulatory requirement on trash. But you have to do these reports annually. So there's a difference between the water pumped out of the ground and the water metered as being sold. And there are certain unmetered uses, district use, but then there's also a difference in the accuracy of some meters. And federal agencies, state agencies, just do not allow you to say this is the average meter. But I know the meters are turbo meters like we have at single-family residential dwellings, the three-quarter-inch meters, are inaccurate. Known to be that way, and they read low.
I think, as we discussed in the trash meeting, that they really don't use that much. What do you say, 110 gallons to fill?
It's they have a 325 gallon tank. If they fill it twice in a day, that's one unit. So if you look on your water bill, it'll show how many units of water you use in a month. Yeah. Commonly, it's 5 or 6. Sometimes it's 10. That's a normal for a single-family residential. So what we're looking at is $28 units per month at a cost of, if the district charged, $75 to $100.
We're not charging them to use the water. Are we getting any
We currently charge them to fill the tank at the yard. So if we're not going to let them use the hydrants, they would have to drive back to the yard and run whatever the gas is. So that would increase their cost. I did not compute the fuel cost.
I think just let them use the hydrants. Don't make them go back and forth. And it's not that much money. I think fair. These guys are doing they're doing sweeping for us. They're agreeing to do sweeping for us twice.
Yeah, also trash service at this location is free.
We're getting.
They do? Yeah. They pick up trash here for free. If they were to charge us for the trash they pick up, it would be more than this.
I look at it as a mutual, maybe as goodwill.
So just to put some numbers to it, right, so Director Murphy says one unit a day, right, so it's 52 weeks in a year, 5 working days in a week, right, so 52 times 5 times, and we charge, let's just say a unit of water is $2.50, it's $2, trivial. So to his point, I think it's just inappropriate. I mean, they can fill up at a hydrant. We can mark this number and use this as part of our water loss.
Is
that an action item?
We are reporting the activity from the committee meeting.
Very good.
another committee meeting was the budget workshop one, but all of you weren't in attendance. Finally.
Can we get a review?
Unless you want
to
go on the
line. Take it easy on those.
All right. We're moving on to action items. First, item A, Director's Memorandum 2025-32.
All right, I have some slides. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is, I think, the fourth time this has been on the agenda. I think we're at the finish line here. But just to summarize everything, I did prepare some slides. A new one?
No, but the attachment is very finicky. So, I guess I could
sleep in. All right, why don't you just push me through? All right, so again, a little bit of background. So the Board Policies and Procedures Manual serves as a guiding document for governance and decision-making processes amongst the board. Purpose of this update, so why did we start this process back in February? Well, it was last updated 8 years ago, April of 2017. Likely, we want a document that is compliant, up-to-date, and aligns with best practices and clarity for board operations. So the current status, so I'm not going to hash out everything that we've done the last couple of meetings, right? At the end of the last board meeting on April 17th, there's three main things. Two of them were language changes, and I've highlighted them here. So page 7, section 8, we changed teleconference meetings will to teleconference meetings may. And then the second change was page 16, section 18, audio/visual, which changed to audio and visual, right? So those are changes that we did make. Now, there is a third request for an opinion from our legal counsel. An opinion from our legal counsel with reference specifically to the public comment section of the board meeting. I'm not going to read the bullet point, right, but the opinion from the legal counsel, I do have it up here. I apologize. So the bullet point in question was this. Members of the board shall not engage in dialogue or respond to speakers during public comment, except as necessary to clarify procedural matters or refer items to staff for follow-up. So I reached out to our general counsel, John Harper. He gave me an email back. I have quoted it on page 2. Essentially what it says is this language, as it's written in the draft version of the manual, comes from the Brown Act Government Code Section 54954.2A3. In a sense, the purpose of this was so the board and members of the public do not get into back and forth, since whatever the topic is that member of the public wants to discuss was not on the agenda. What the board should do appropriately would be to listen to them, and if it requires clarification, you can ask those questions, or if it requires board action, to agendize that for a future board meeting. But based upon the response from our general counsel, I have not modified that original bullet point, and is our recommendation for that.
That's what that podium is for at the beginning.
Correct. So if a member of the public wants to talk about something that's not on the agenda, they can do that. What this bullet point is saying is that there should not be a back and forth between the board and the public unless it's to just ask clarifying questions or to direct staff further.
Basically, getting the board to go back and forth with the residents.
Right. But, I mean, we generally, like we had a guy who wasn't getting his trash picked up, commercial property.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so you would direct them to staff to investigate the issue. Or if it's something that required board attention, we could agendize that particular issue on the next board meeting.
So if he decides he wants to fire all of us, then that's when we can end it.
Then we should agendize that for a future board meeting.
So when we direct them to staff is the one who is the group of people that would have conversations with.
Yeah, we would coordinate with them if whatever that he was concerned about gravitated to the level of the board, then we would agendize. So that's the basis for the bullet point. It comes from the Brown Act, that government code.
I thought you were talking about something other than.
No, specifically when you want to talk about a non-agenda item.
All right.
So I asked for this legal opinion. I'd like to read the opinion that's in the on the second page of this DM, the sixth paragraph down.
second sentence, the language of in the board policy is derived from a section which provides a limited exception allowing board members or staff to respond briefly to statements or questions raised by members of the public. Comments portion of the meeting we'll talk about later in the meeting. So that's what's written in the DM, and that's not how I interpret this language. The language in the language that was added by staff in the board policy and procedures says that it just, I'll read that. Members of the board shall not engage in dialogue or respond to speakers during public comment, except as necessary to clarify procedural matters or refer items to. So I don't interpret that as the same. Sometimes people will say things and you don't understand what they're saying. I will give you an example. Back in February of last year, Mary Mangold came by, who was saying, I can't get my trash picked up because there's a bunch of water in the street. That didn't make any sense to me. I had to get more information from her during the meeting. And it turns out there was a bunch of water in the street. So I got together with her and I went to this town hall. Talk to the her elected representative at the town hall about this problem. She got referred to staff, didn't even get to ask that elected representative questions she was meant to ask. That problem still persists. We know what happened to that elected representative. Right, Leslie?
Yes, they're talking about me, Murphy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, going back to this, is this because there are board policies that are set forth because of the Brown Act? These are things that we have to follow. You not have, the meetings are not for you to answer questions to any resident that you do. They're for you to take the information, and if you can put it on the agenda, you will. Meanwhile, it should be directed to staff, not you.
So, what this language says is, except as necessary to clarify procedural matters, that means we'd be talking to staff. And if I don't understand what somebody is saying, I'm going to ask them to clarify what they're saying. So what I'd like to do is strike the words procedural matters. So except as necessary to obtain clarification or refer the items to staff or follow-up.
I think it's saying because that's what it's recommended by council.
In all honesty, we have always given everybody plenty of time to carry any grievance they've got. We've never been too busy. Places never packed too much to let somebody air whatever it is they want to say. Despite what we decide on board policies and procedures, we always let people talk here. I'm here.
We will cut them off when I was president, we let them air it, and we would cut them off when the time was right.
But we always give people plenty of time for anything they want looked at. And Martha's helped us so many times with the people we over to Martha.
And that's what you're doing.
So what I'm saying is it's what we have now is working.
Not for the, to limit the public, to limit.
I need to say something here. I don't believe for 1 minute that anything that Leslie did was a result of her not getting reelected. And I don't think this is a proper venue to bring that up. I've heard of that fix. All I have to say.
But I think going back to this, this is a manual for us as board members.
Yeah.
That we should be following, even when they tend to try to be little staff or yelling at them. There's a proper conduct that we should be following, and this is why we have these boards and procedures in place.
Luckily, I can only remember one situation. He really has a
So I'll just go to the recommendation. So right there's two items that have changed. Items from the slide. Right. So it's our recommendation for you to discuss this one last time and look to adopt today.
I hear you. I can't see a problem with this.
If I'm the only one that has a problem with not responding to members of the public, then there's no second on my motion.
That's correct.
If people come in here and they have a problem and you just sit there silent, then I think it is easy for them to get offended.
But like
there are times when people come in and you don't understand what they're saying, you need to be able to respond to them. And I'm not saying that's if they're here to seek redress of grievances from their elected officials should need to listen to them and on occasion need to be able to say something. And what this change to the board procedure that was added by staff, it is censorship of the board. Prior to, I think that this modification should not be in the board policies and procedures. I think we should strike the whole thing. If we're not going to strike that, I move that we change, clarify procedural matters to seek clarification. If there's no second, it dies for lack of a second, and you can move on to the next vote.
Motion.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? I am opposed.
Okay. So we move on to action item B, Director's Memorandum 2025-33.
Before we move on, would the board like a bound fresh copy of the new policies and procedures manual?
I think that would be fair.
Moving on to 8B, Miguel.
Thank you.
project that originally that $47,000 was thought it would cover everything. That wasn't the case. It wasn't included in my budget. Staff recommend $20,000 from restricted reserves, line item 7425, general fund budget, R&M office building fund, and that from $38,000 to $50,000. As of April 28, 2025, so that obviously about $5 million.
That's going to cover all the plants.
That's going to cover
to finish it off completely.
To finish it off, right? So 64, 1047 from Western. We added 3,000. One grand. Recommendation is for one, except the revised landscape for the office. Two, approved allocation of 20,000 out of pocket cost. District's unrestricted reserves fund to the R&M office building.
Is that going to have an entrance out by the front, or how are people going to enter? I didn't have a chance yet.
No, you're not supposed to, like, walk on top of it. So there is...
I thought there was, like, a pathway.
Oh, yeah, there'll be a decorative pathway.
Yeah, that's what I mean. How do they get...
Or not a walking pathway.
Yeah, it's a DG pathway.
Yeah,
so...
I apologize. I shouldn't have answered. That's Miguel's. Sorry about that.
The entrance of the building just go across from that? Maybe
from the front. It'll be from the side.
Okay.
The sidewalk.
Move to strike from the budget offense. sight distance is 100 feet and the stopping sight distance is 300 feet, you can only see 150 feet down that road.
I hear you, and I understand your concern, but if they're billing for labor that we've already done, we can't just write there and say we're not going to pay because we don't like it. What we can do is maybe ask you guys to lower it or see if we can lower that.
I could probably move it back or
can you do that?
Pie shape it a little bit. On the...
We can look into that. Yeah. That's my fault. One of the things I didn't think about, I apologize, but it's something that we can look into. I hear what you're saying. You're not the first person to bring that to my attention. We will look and see if my whole thing was just to protect it, right? I mean, that was my objective with that, was just to protect it. As Miguel mentioned, there's constantly people going up and down Rubidoux. A lot of times they ride their bikes on the grass. I would hope to think that they wouldn't do it in a nice demonstration garden. I don't have that level of comfort, so I wanted to protect it. So I understand it's a visual hazard, and it's something that we can look into.
I think there's a solution to that, and I don't think it's that drastic, whether it be lower it down a little bit. So I'd make a motion to approve this, but on the condition that we do look into making adjustments.
I agree.
I'd like to modify that we have a design professional design the fence.
That's going to be a lot of money.
No, I think
so you can have any registered civil engineer check the site.
We can have a fence guy can do that. Elrod put that in, didn't he? If Elrod did it, I have a lot of faith in that company. Homeowner situation is Elrod.
Is there any motion in a second?
Wait, if the thing is that we may be looking at legal actions here, if we don't do it by...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Bring it up to... What I'm saying is bring it up to Elrod. Bring it up to Elrod. Okay, let's do this. Can we get Elrod to take a look at it? See if they feel they can do this. What'd you say, the sideline, Murphy, 600 feet?
Paperwork I produced.
So what Murphy said... The allowable amount of distance, if Elrod can take a look at it, tell Elrod our situation. Elrod feels that that's something they can take care of. But if Elrod can't, Elrod says he don't want to take the responsibility of making it legal, I guess you'd call it, then I'd go for a discipline. At this point, there's no way. Elrod knows what they're doing.
So Elrod didn't get it right the first time.
We just told them to fence it. No, I mean, they're going to do what they're told. Oh, you guys want to see?
So, it would be better if this stuff was shown on the plan before it went to bid. It wasn't shown on the plan. It went to bid. Then we started changing the plan.
Okay.
And now we're talking about changing the plan again. What I'd like to do is have the plan modified to show what we want constructed and then have it constructed. And the way things are going, we're going to be planting new plants in the middle of summer. I'm not a landscape professional. I'm not a botanist. But I don't know that planting new plants in the middle of summer is ideal. And we were told that they were going to clear the weeds. That was the cause of the delay. And as you sit at that stop sign and you look to the left, you're welcome to look at the ground.
Well, I stand on the motion. I made the motion to correct this, get Elrod out, on the conditions that Elrod looks at it, correct it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
I am opposed.
So be it. Next item C, Director's Memorandum
2025-34. All right, Brandon. So, 2025-34 is progress on the local hazard mitigation plan. So, in 2023, the board approved a local hazard mitigation plan to be written, and through that we applied for a grant. We got a grant to pay for it to be written, and there was a little hang up in 2023 with some different regulation changes, but now we're back on it and we've developed the plan. We've identified all of our stakeholder list, and come up with the flyers and all the information that we need to get out to our customers. And this is the presentation that you'll see here from the consultant that we had working on this. Yep. My computer. So it's restarted.
Samples of mitigation. Hazard mitigation reduces disaster damage and is defined by FEMA as sustained actions taken to reduce or eliminate the long-term risk to human life and property. Examples of mitigation actions include outreach programs to make awareness, projects to protect critical facilities, and the removal of structures from flood hazard areas. In 2019, National Institute of Building Sciences issued an update to its landmark report, Natural Hazard Mitigation Saved. The study analyzed the benefit-cost ratio of range of mitigation activities, including mitigation planning, building retrofits. The findings revealed a dramatic return on investment. For mitigation activities, every dollar spent yielded a $6 return on avoided losses in the future. Also, for building retrofits, every dollar spent yielded a $4 return on avoided losses. According to the National Institute of Building Sciences report, the benefits of mitigation include reductions in deaths, injuries, and post-traumatic stress disorders, property repair costs for damaged buildings and contents, additional living expenses, including sheltering costs for displaced households, direct business interruption, including loss of revenue and other business interruption costs to businesses whose property is damaged. Also, indirect business interruption, including loss of economic activity in the broader community. And lastly, urban search and rescue. In 2023, FEMA issued new standards regarding preparation of hazard mitigation plans. In addition to the previous regulations from 2011, jurisdictions are now required to discuss climate change and the impacts of natural hazards. Also, now there are standards requiring focused outreach to managed communities and socially vulnerable populations. Mitigation plans are key to breaking the cycle of disaster damage and reconstruction. Mitigation planning begins with state, tribal, and local governments identifying natural disaster risks and vulnerabilities that are common in their areas. After identifying risks, they develop long-term strategies for protecting people and property from similar events. Local governments are eligible to prepare a mitigation plan and receive mitigation funds through federal and state grants as well as funds following a major disaster. FEMA's 2023 Local Mitigation Planning Handbook identifies the planning process with four steps. Step number one is to organize the planning process and resources, which includes creation of a planning team, assist with research and writing, as well as the development of a community outreach strategy. Step number two is to assess risks and capabilities, including a risk and vulnerability assessment, as well as a review of the district's capability to respond to and recover from major disasters. Step number three is to develop a mitigation strategy, which includes a comprehensive list of mitigation actions and projects. Step number four is to adopt and implement the plan, which includes a formal review by Cal OES and FEMA and adoption by the Board of Directors. This is the four-step planning process followed by the district planning team. The community outreach strategy includes three phases. The first phase is developing a stakeholder list and announcing the planning process. The stakeholders include local local and regional agencies involved in hazard mitigation activities. Agencies that have the authority to regulate development, neighboring jurisdictions, representatives of business, academia, pipelines, and nonprofit and community-based organizations focused on underserved communities and vulnerable populations. The second phase is announcing the planning process activities to customers and stakeholders, including a press release, dedicated website, social media, public forums, all used to help to announce the availability of a hazard mitigation survey, briefings at public forums, including the board of directors, and the hazard mitigation overview video. The third phase is gathering input on the first draft plan, which includes announcing the availability of the plan for input from customers and stakeholders. Identifying hazards with the project involves reviewing a range of hazard-focused studies and plans. The hazard identification process includes a review of FEMA's list of 18 hazards that are recommended for consideration. Next, California State Hazard Mitigation Plan, including top hazards, earthquake, flood, and wildfire. Then the County of Riverside's multi-jurisdictional hazard mitigation plan and the City of Harupa Valley's general plan safety element, including top hazards, earthquake, flood, and wildfire. But following that review, the planning team identified drought, earthquake, flood, wildfire, and windstorm as the hazards posing the greatest. The district's capabilities were mentioned in the previous slide. One of the FEMA requirements is to identify existing capabilities to improve resilience. Also, the mitigation plan is required to identify ways to expand existing capabilities. The capability categories include planning and regulatory, administrative and technical, financial, and education and outreach. The mitigation strategy section includes the goals as well as methods for coordinating with the capital improvement plan. Most importantly, the mitigation strategy includes a comprehensive range of actions, projects, capturing ongoing activities along with ideas for the future. Although the lifespan of the plan is only 5 years, there's no harm in identifying projects that will take 10 or even 20 years to complete. Each action item identifies the lead department, timeline, plan goals met, projected funding source, and benefits, costs, and priorities. Here's an example of a mitigation action item. Purchase and install generators for all district funds. Following drafting of the plan by the planning team, gathering input from the public and other stakeholders, the document will be submitted to Cal OES for a formal review. Utilizing FEMA's plan review tool and updated regulations, the Cal OES staff will review the district's plan for conformance. Once Cal OES is satisfied that all the requirements have been met, the document will be forwarded to FEMA. Altogether, the formal review typically takes approximately 4 to 6 months. Once FEMA is satisfied, a letter will be sent authorizing the district to take the document to the Board of Directors for adoption. When proof of adoption is received, FEMA will issue a letter of approval. This concludes the hazard mitigation overview. Please watch for the posting of the draft hazard mitigation plan. We look forward to hearing your questions, thoughts, and suggestions. On behalf of the district, thank you for taking time to learn about the importance of increasing resilience through mitigation planning.
So we find ourselves currently in the second phase. We've developed the stakeholder list. We are ready to send it out with the communication materials. That includes this wonderful, lengthy slideshow with a speech on it and our hazard mitigation flyer that will be mailed out to all of our customers in the bills. It'll be English on one side and Spanish on the other. The QR code will link you to our website and this. Oh, I'm sorry. The QR code will link you to a survey. And the survey is just for all the customers and then all those stakeholders they spoke about. And really, it's just what hazards do you think, what are hazards are important to you? Is there something in your area you think needs to be looked out for? And we will gather that information. It'll come back to us, and then we will consider those things, put them in the draft plan, and then we will, again, reach out to the public, show them the draft plan, and see if they have any more comments. We will bring that in, finalize the draft, send it to Cal OES and FEMA. They'll adopt it, or they'll approve it, and then we'll bring it to you guys to adopt it.
So I got a question now. Implementing this program, it seems to me that will facilitate grant funding.
Yes, especially right now. Right now, the Cal OES just opened grant DR 4856 because of the recent wildfires. The notice of intent to apply for grants is on it ends on May 29th. The local hazard mitigation plan being completed by that time is not a requirement because the funding for these projects will not get granted until 2027. Yes, but this is why it's important for us to have shelved projects, right? Like this reservoir, if we go through the planning phase on this reservoir that we're talking about building that may take a full year to go through that planning phase, and we're going to be in 2027 before you know it, and we'll be ready to break ground, ready to go.
So this is what you were talking about when you were talking about shelving projects
yep.
in the future.
Yep.
So that's good.
So, yeah, and with these grants, there's no cap on this yet. The federal government hasn't put a cap on it yet, so that's really good for us, and it's only a 25% cost match. So this could be really huge for us. And it's really big for infrastructure projects, so and system resiliency, so developing new sources, wells, connections with other agencies, and then reinforcing infrastructure, so doing seismic upgrades on all of our tanks, like all that kind of stuff, increasing our storage, right? Also, this grant that we're going to apply for this month, these grants is right up our alley. And we're going to specify those in the plan. It should look real good for us.
This is a non-action item. We've been working on this for a couple of years. That voice you heard is the consultant that the board hired a couple of years ago. So she's done a number of local hazard mitigation plans in the surrounding area. She did one for JCSD a couple of years ago. We did an RFP, and she was the lowest responsible bidder. I think we had 4 responses. So we've been working with her for a couple of years. As Brandon mentioned, there was changes to the regulations of FEMA, right? So this kind of went dormant for 6 months, or maybe even more than 6 months. But those regulations have since been finalized, and she's pushed through other plans with other agencies. So she knows her model will work for Rubino at this point. That's how we're kind of pushing forward. We're at the public outreach stage, right? So the survey, this QR code is active now. If you were to pull out your phone now and scan it, it is active, right? So we're trying to next week push all that out. Website, social media, it will go in the May bills, the 510 and the 520 May bills, in the press enterprise. And this will run probably to early June.
Brandon, besides yourself, who's part of your team for this?
So this started well before I got here. So it's Miguel and Ted basically headed up this. Now it'll be Miguel, myself, and Jacqueline that will reinforce these projects and make sure that they're all included in this every step of the way.
You'll keep us updated?
Yes, absolutely. The requirements that change are all this notification. In 2020, prior to 2023, none of this was there. I co-authored HARUPAs in 2020, and it was nothing like this. This is much, much more technical and all-inclusive for the community, but this is going to be great.
Great question. It's develop a stakeholder list. You consider utility companies like the telephone company and the power company?
Yes.
So, we consider public safety power shutoffs to be a hazard because they cause sewer spills?
Yes.
Here's one thing I'm not understanding. Our listed hazards are drought, earthquake, flood, wildfire, and windstorm.
one of the pieces of data we're collecting is people's skin color. I don't understand how the hazard varies based on skin color.
This survey was put together by and approved by Cal OES as the questions that needed to be asked for this survey. So this is what we're implementing.
So wildfires impact people differently based on their skin color. Know what we're saying?
We're asking, we're trying to understand
I think what we're saying is we did not draft the survey. This is a standard survey that's been used for other jurisdictions. Is that what we're saying?
I am equally concerned about the impact on people caused by earthquakes and wildfires and public safety power shutoffs without regard for their socioeconomic status or their skin color. But they're going to collect this data anyway. And the purpose of collecting that data is, I presume the purpose of collecting this information is to determine grant status, who gets money and who doesn't get it.
Right, because many years and there's been a lot more challenges for people of color and people that have socioeconomic challenges. It's not the same for everyone, so they have to collect this information. There's more federal funding. This is why they put it in their question. It makes a difference. Depending on where you live, because of redlining, because of all these effects that have happened over the years. So it's good to have that data there that they are requesting for them to be able to put in more money into it. Because we think that because of your skin color, you're going to just make a difference. No, the federal government requires that.
Are we still under disenfranchised?
Disadvantaged community?
Yeah.
It's not binary. It's not yes or no. There's, if I had to put, it's this percentage. There's different areas, right? So when we do file recent, or when we do file grant applications, there's metrics set by the state. So we're like 65-70% disadvantaged.
Okay.
So it's not binary. It's not all yes or
all
no.
Can they take that into effect when they're...
Yeah.
Well, if you were to look at the grant applications that we submit, there's multiple pages designated that talks about disadvantaged communities.
But you guys also, when I go to the PK meetings and all these meetings that I know, that is the school that has the most community. Coming up right next to us. So it's always one of the most challenges, or it usually has more funding opportunities from the federal government. So right next.
I want to ask you guys a question. Do you want to continue or take a 5-minute break?
Yeah, I'm okay with continuing, but if that's
on the board, I'm good to go.
Good to go, okay. Item D, action item D, Director's Memorandum 2025-35.
All right, so this is an annual thing that we do. I have some slides. So this is the annual revision of the employee handbook. So a little bit of background, the employee handbook. I think the board members get a copy of it when they first come on. I think both of you definitely got one. It's a massive document. It's like 150 pages. It's supposed to be a user, for, I mean, it's 150 pages, but it is supposed to be a user. No, that's the MOU. Handbook is much bigger. So it is 150 pages, but it is supposed to be a user-friendly resource.
Looks like this.
Yes. That's two of them in one, probably, right? Because you have the red line and the...
I know it takes two binder clicks.
And this includes general information, including but not limited to compensation, benefits, policies, relevant state and federal laws, holidays, vacations, all that kind of stuff. It does not replace the MOU, so Director Altamirano just held up the MOU, so it does not replace the MOU, supplements it, right? The MOU is the Memorandum of Understanding with their bargaining unit. So, as I mentioned, we update this annually to stay compliant with current federal and state laws. As you can imagine, 150 pages. As I read this yearly, I'm finding new just grammatical formatting errors that I just doesn't sit right with me if I want to get those corrected. And then just every now and then there's operational adjustments that need to be incorporated into this manual based upon staff preferences. So with regards to the 2025 proposed updates, I kind of look at them two ways. One, there's the updates that need to be made based upon state and federal law, right? So when we go through this process, we have our labor council review this, right? And he will make his own recommendations based upon federal and state law, right? So those are not language that staff drafted up. That is language that he's drafted up. And I highlight those later in the slides. And then there's the staff changes, right? There's the non-substantive changes, as I just mentioned, that the grammar, formatting, and numbering corrections. And then there are the substantive changes, and I will highlight those, or I will detail those later in the slides. There's two subcategories within the substantive changes. There's consistency with the MOU. So you may recall we signed a new MOU end of June last year. So this revision was done prior to that MOU becoming effective. So there's some difference in language that I want to clean up for consistency. And then there's a couple of operational changes. Okay, the Labor Council updates. There's five policies. I'm not going to read them. I provided a redline copy and a clean copy. So if you were to take those policies, you can find them and find the Labor Council proposed changes. But the changes that he proposed, drug and alcohol, unlawful harassment, family and medical leave, sick leave, timekeeping, and time records. So again, those are the employee handbook changes based upon recommendations from staff labor council. And then there are staff changes. As I mentioned, the MOU was passed after the revisions last year, right? So to keep it consistent, I'm proposing changes to this handbook to mirror the new MOU, and those were five policies: hours of work and overtime, nepotism, holidays, sick leave, and vacation. Again, I'm not going to go through all of the changes. So the purpose of today is to distribute and to highlight everything. I understand reading 150 pages in 48 hours is just not feasible. So the plan is to distribute this and then come back at a future board meeting to adopt it. And then the operational changes, very minimal, but I will detail them. So one is policy 2130, performance evaluation. I guess you can consider this a substantive change. I don't. It's just more of changing the naming convention in the policy to match our current evaluation forms. As far as how we evaluate employees, that's not changing. It's just changing the naming convention as it currently reads in the policy. The second one is the cell phone program, right? So this is an existing policy. What this proposal is an expansion of the existing program for emergency and certain administrative staff to provide greater connectivity district-wide amongst our staff. And then the third one, policy 2215, gifts, entertainment, and gratuities. So again, this is an existing policy. This is an expansion and a more practical for modern times. So I wrote this in alignment with the Fair Political Practices Commission, the FPPC, which you should be familiar with. That's the Form 700. So the old policy, I think it was a couple of sentences, $25. That was years and years, years ago. This is just something that makes sense for more modern times. If the board doesn't like that, then I'll remove it. I don't really care. I just thought when I was looking at it, it made sense in 2025. I mean, we have an FPPC that sets these guidelines. Why not mirror that? So that was just the recommendation there. So the two attachments, I'm sorry, we killed some trees providing that to you. I apologize. I know that some of the board members like the physical copies. So what I'll probably not do 2 weeks from now, I will not send out the packets again. I will just have them on, not the packets. I won't send out the handbook again. I will have them on our website in PDF form. Well, then you can have mine. Yeah. So the two attachments, like I said, the redline version, that's the entire policy redline. So there's many policies that did not change, right? Instead of trying to just piecemeal it all together, I just figured let's just provide everything so you can look at everything. And then the clean version. So as I mentioned, if you look at the full board packet online, these attachments, 2025, 35, are in there. But then I also have them as standalone PDFs in that section of the website. So the timeline, I sent this to the bargaining union representatives last Friday. Today, May 1st, I distributed it to the board of directors for review and discussion. By May 12th, which is a Monday, I asked that the board submit any comments that they have to me so I can incorporate them into the May 5th board meeting and then look to adopt this May 15th. So I think the big takeaway is, I mean, of all the changes, like 50% of them are labor council, 40% of them are based upon the MOU, just for consistency, and about 20% or 10% or things that we as staff would like to change operationally. So the recommendation is review the proposed revisions and submit comments to staff by May 12th, and then consider adopting the revised employee handbook on May 15th.
I think we have.
I mean, I don't have to have it right now.
We're going to extract them from those four packets.
I think it's always good to be updating. There's nothing wrong with that, going back and seeing what we can improve.
I'd like to be able
to do that. Also, want to make sure that
what
we're changing
isn't going to affect any of the I want to make sure. Is there a hard copy of this in the break room so that any employee can improve this?
Every employee has been provided their own copy, either when they start or when there's a comprehensive revision.
Then this thing has an index page at the first two or three sheets.
Yep.
So do we indicate on the index page which? Do we provide on the index page which ones have modifications?
No. Just if the titles have changed.
We could, for the policies that are changed, we could get the index and highlight that up. Like, this is the one, these are the ones that have changes from what you received previously. What I would suggest is that on the PDF of the, on the website, that we highlight the numbers of the sections that have modifications before you post it. I would suggest that we post those, that index in the break room, so that any employee that's interested in what is changing, what rules are changing for what they've understood in the past, they're notified of that. Then when you talk about labor bargaining unit, or what was the term you used for the person you provided this to?
A bargaining unit?
No, it's their representative.
It's representative, okay.
Yeah. So we have what they call like a shop foreman or something like that.
Stewards?
Shop stewards. And my understanding is that both of the shop stewards work in the office. There isn't like a field shop steward.
No, there is.
So we have one in the field, one in the office. Is that the people that got the document?
Sent it to the main LIUNA representative and both stewards, yes.
Okay. So the stewards have a copy similar to what the board has. And if you could just take the three sheets or the two sheets that are indexed and highlight the ones that are changing so that if somebody wants to go to the website because they're curious about it, it would be helpful. You guys have a board in the lunchroom?
Yes. Well, it's right before the lunchroom, but it's on the wall, it's on the hallway, we're walking to. Yeah.
I think we ought to notice the employees that work.
Okay.
Simple enough.
Next item, item E, Director's Memorandum 2025-36.
So this one, at our last board meeting, we asked for the board's direction on, in regards to, I'll kind of just discuss them, so kind of this 36, 2025, 36, 37, essentially on the same PowerPoint right here. We're talking about adjusting the water and sewer rates. Last board meeting. meeting, we went through the process of getting the board's approval to start this process. And we did kind of go over this PowerPoint presentation, so this slide should look familiar to you. This discussed how the district went to a five-year rate plan 2 years ago, and we're entering the third year of our rate plan. This is just information to kind of show you the history of that. Get ahead to the schedule, though. But I do have it. So this was our proposed timeline that we brought up during the last meeting. It was to prepare the draft of the ordinance and do a first reading at today's meeting. We will be posting in the Press Enterprise. I think it goes out on Saturday. So it will be posted 10 days in advance as far as giving the public notice of a public hearing, which we intend to have at the May 15th board meeting. And then if approved and adopted at the May 15th board meeting, then it requires a 30-day delay to take effect. What we would do is if it gets approved in May 15th, we would have them go in later than 30 days. We would have them be effective July 1st. And so that would be the goal of that. So this kind of refreshes you on the timeline. So today is the first reading of these ordinances with continued approval, we would go to the May 15th for the second reading and the public hearing. And if successful, then we would go for board adoption at that next meeting, 15th. So kind of just to show you.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, actually. That's our rate plan. So this is the water rate. This is where we're at now. Where we were going, so you can have status charges for like depending on the price of your meter. It's a fixed charge that goes automatically, and then you would have a variable charge based on your usage. Right now, you know, 1 through 13 units, you just charge $251 each unit. Go up to the 14th unit, and then and so on and so forth. You start getting a higher rate, and you'll see a variety of different rate structures from districts. But this would be the proposed rates to go to if effective in July 1st, and approximately 5.5% increase. We've kind of gone through this with the budget meeting. Same thing, this is the wastewater, it's a 7% increase. Right now, it's a static charge. And then the non-residential has a variable rate, but residential. So these are kind of the history where we've been at compared to other people. So this is our rate study, and this is back in December 20. This is what we kind of looked like there, and this is what our proposed increase was. Other districts, our rate study. Kind of cheated, and I went to other people's rate studies because other districts doing this is self-funded. This is JCSD. They did it in March 16, 2024. This is kind of what we were looking at compared to them when they were doing their rate study. These are based on a single family home, 3/4 inch, at 19 units for that bill. This is how we would look. This was our older unit. Kind of see that we trend generally on the lower half of these. And then cheated again. Luckily, Norco did one not too long ago, March 25. And this is where we weren't listed in their comparisons, so I put up in there. This is based on 20 units for the 3/4 inch meter. And I have to say, but this is combined. All these have been combined, water and sewer, for single family home with a 3/4 inch meter.
We want to live in Corona.
I think that one had something going on with Tejas. But Corona has typically been high.
That is.
So I don't think it's 200. That one didn't really check out to me. The other ones did. But you can see where Corona's going. They're going up $12 a month, right? So you can see that that's a significant change. I think they're going up 9% mark. And now, depending on the rate structure, they may do it 9% down. It depends on what they like to do, though. So this is where we're currently at with our rate structure right now in our second year. So based on 20 units, so the 3/4 inch meter, your bill for water and sewer would be $118.30. And then with the proposed rate increase, you would up to $125.41. And where we would kind of fall on that chart compared to the fees.
think they're going through their upper Elk River.
You're thinking of Western.
Oh.
Yeah, Western has always been not Riverside. So this current, I thought they're still pretty low.
Yeah.
They might have the economies of scale compared to us. I don't know the exact
code. Or they might have general fund transfers. Yeah. So it depends on how they're structuring that.
Some of the money that we pay Riverside for sewer services at the treatment goes into their general fund.
Mm-hmm.
So we are paying for reduced rates there.
So they're not paying surcharges like we pay to the city of Riverside to treat the water.
This is just more of a visual to kind of help you understand where there are obviously different homes have different sets used. This was just easier to use with kind of common thing. It seemed like a lot of the rate studies were using. Generally in the past, I think we used 18 units as a comparison. This one was based on 19. And show where we're at. But you can just see how we compare. So I tried to visualize it for you just to show you where we're at. And these, honestly, this JPSD rate will go higher because this is their current rate. And this is where they raised it. If you go with their rate plan, a lot of these are probably their current rate. And I think they would go up even higher based on their annual. Okay, so like you can see that we would still be on the lower end, even when they go raise the rates after us. Or they're going through the same process, right? So they're all usually some of the people we all get emails sometimes to like, hey, how much you're going up this year, how much are you doing for COLA or whatever, a lot of them talk together to it. But they are using the rate city plan. That's the proposed timeline. I'll leave this up just in case you have any questions. I do think we need to go through the approval for each ordinance individually, but I kind of just want to talk about them together.
Yeah, I mean, not to belabor this, but we're at the budget. I know we didn't get to sewer, but, you know, we'll get to it in 2 weeks. But the water side, right, so what we earn in rates, right, has to do kind of three – what we charge or the rate revenue that we earn has to do kind of three things. Got to cover the current year O&M costs, right, like bare minimum. Got to cover any projects that we have, right, and it's got to help with reserves. Right, so that's like the trifecta that we have to think about. So, I mean, nobody likes to raise rates. I think the general takeaway is that this particular industry, the last couple of years especially, like things are just astronomically expensive. So you're seeing a lot of our service providers in the area are having to increase their rates, which, you know, water, sewer, I know you hear about it on the electrical side, SoCal Edison, like it's unfortunate, but it's a reality for us. I mean, we have a lot of projects that we're trying to do. They are not cheap, and, you know, we're smaller scale magnitude than JCSD or Western, but, you know, we don't get major discounts on projects unless we subsidize that through grant funding.
Thank you for your presentation. I think we already know what we need to do, right?
There's two questions I have on this. There's the water usage or the comparison you're using 20 units. Is that right?
Yeah, just to show the flow and make it easier on the comparison. So that's what I did on that one. Yeah.
And that selection of the 20 units is based on one.
That's what,
like a reasonable number, or that's common amongst people around here?
Historically, it's common, but then historically we've always been 18. But when I saw other rate studies, it seemed common to be in that ballpark of an area that they were all evaluated.
So for a single family residential
family, a single family 3/4 inch meter that has about 4 people living in the house, traditionally 18 to 20.
All right, and then is it possible to get a comparison of the R rates? Just the baseline water, sewer, and trash, and compare that to the rate of inflation. You have so there's what we have been charging in the past, not including water use, but just the base ones. Do you have that readily available?
At the as a single year or over multiple years?
Over multiple years.
How did that come forward?
At least 2017.
We don't have that readily available, but we can compile that. I mean, that's information that we can.
All right, and then to use the annual percentage of inflation using that CPI-U, that's what the trash is.
I don't remember.
All right, and then they have a baseline number. It was 100, and they just kept going up from there. But you set you graph the R rates compared to the cost of inflation from the whatever the year you start with, 2017. That would be helpful to see if R rates are rising faster than the rate of inflation or lower than the rate of inflation. It would help me a great deal.
I will certainly do that.
Okay. We'll move on to item F.
Well,
if
we
for
got
that,
one,
it is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We have to take action. There needs to be a motion.
Yeah,
yeah.
Start with
for both of them.
For the public
hearing.
But let's do them one at a time.
So for action item E, which is Director's Memorandum 2025, I'm going to move to approve the staff recommendation.
Second.
All
those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion passes.
All right, for item S, Director's Memorandum 2025-37, I'm going to move to approve the staff recommendation.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. Director Memorandum 2025-38.
All right. Last but certainly not least, you know, in the spirit of great water and sewer, we do provide trash. That is an important service that we provide. Somewhere. So this has been a reoccurring theme going back January, but I'm gonna go back there. I'm gonna start there in January. So I guess I'm gonna start even further than that. So as you are well aware of by now, being residents of Fruitful Valley, the district has a contract with Vertex Waste Industries. Vertex is the exclusive hauler in this area of Fruitful Valley, I guess in the entire city of Fruitful Valley. But there's separate contracts. We have a contract with Vertex. The west portion of Fruitful Valley has a contract with Vertex. Our contract with Vertex goes back to 2008. So the Solid Waste Committee, right? The Solid Waste Committee changes on an annual basis. This current iteration of the Solid Waste Committee has met quite regularly going back to January. And there's been two main focuses of the Solid Waste Committee. One is an amendment to the existing agreement. As I mentioned, we're operating off an agreement from 2008, right, so the Solid Waste Committee and Vertex representatives, and this has been brought up during the board meetings, during committee reports. But the main focus of the amendment is you know, contract length, annual rate caps, residential rate comparison with City of Fruitful Valley, street sweeping, and then kind of these other free services that we've discussed from time to time, that being bulky items, used oil collection, used battery collection, community cleanups, among others. You know, the focus of this is not really the contract amendment. That time will come, but just to comment on that briefly, I think the terms are close on that. I think the committee anticipates having one more solid waste committee and then move to have full board adoption and hopefully a new amendment, I guess, to the existing contract before July 1. But today's focus is the fiscal year 25-26 collection and disposal rate. So as I mentioned, we've been at this for a number of meetings now. The Solid Waste Committee has had 5 meetings, and then this has been brought up during committee reports twice here. So a lot of time spent on this. So my focus is, and I know Director Lajan, Director Altamirano, you guys are kind of new, but you know, the bulk of our trash enterprise is residential customers, right? So the revenue is a little bit different, but as far as pure customers, 90% of our customers are residential customers. So a lot of the analysis that we've done over the years has really been to focus on the residential component of the trash enterprise, right? We have about 400 commercial accounts, and that will grow over the coming years. But for purposes of this board, it's been kind of their priority to focus on the residential side. So when it comes to the analysis, that's kind of what we bring up. Because as you see in the rate sheets,
there's a number of different services at a number of different frequencies, so we don't go line by line when it comes to this court. The committee has kind of gone through that. So I'm going to stand up. There's a lot to unpack here. So I know for those who have never sat on the Solid Waste Committee before, don't quite know all the components that goes into the rate. So the customer sees one number, right? They see one number on the bill. That's this bottom number. But there's a lot of components that go into that number, right? And I will just touch upon it briefly. There's what we call the service component. This is the component that FERTech keeps, right? They are a for-profit business. This is their cost of doing business, right? The next three components are what we call these landfill or the county pass-through tipping fees, right? The landfill recycling and mixed organics. So these are pass-through costs to FERTech, who in turn pass them up. There is this fifth line item, SB 1383, admin fee. This is born from the last couple of years with the advent of SB 1383, the short-term climate pollutant reduction act. But it's not going away, right? There's an administrative component to that implementation. And then the sixth component, the RCSD admin fee, right? So trash is an enterprise. Think of trash, water, and sewer as your own individual business, right? We operate the trash enterprise as a business, right? We don't make a profit. We are a nonprofit. We're a government agency. We are not for profit. But at a minimum, we have administrative costs on the trash enterprise that we have to cover. So this small little component of the bill is our what we call holdback to cover our administrative fees running the trash enterprise that goes to salaries, overhead, et cetera. Okay. So all six of these, you'll see in the rate fees, come up to the number that the customer pays. Okay. Any questions on that so far? Okay. I want to talk about stuff on the right hand side. So our rates have not been adjusted since July 1st, 2020. So there's three big things that I want to focus on. This RCS admin fee, I talked about that. It's $1.25 per customer per month. Right? When you put that into perspective, we have about 6,500 residential customers. That generates, Kirk, can you do the math for me, a little over $100,000 a year.
Or?
$1.25 times 6,500 times 12.
6,500
times $1.25 times 4. Okay, $100,000 from residential process for the entire year to cover our administrative process. That doesn't go very far, right? And again, the bulk of our customer base is administrative customers. So I'll get to this later, but this is going to go up. This is going to go up to $2. Right. This number, the 3892, is an important number because this number will match what the rest of City of Fruitwood Valley customers will pay. So this was a big win. I know that there was talk over the last couple of years that the Rubidoux rate was higher than what the rest of Fruitwood Valley was paying. FERTech was very amenable to that argument. So this number for 2526 will match identical for a 90-gallon can. I think that's a huge. So, the big takeaway is this number is going up, but it's going to match. This number is going up, but that's for us. So, where does that shortfall come from? And I want to highlight the service cost. So, FERTech is actually going to make less money under the new rate plan than what they are currently making. Right? So, their service cost is going to go down. Ours is going to go up. That will help cover our administrative costs. That will lessen our need to pull from property tax money. And then this number will match the city of Fruitwood Valley. And again, attachment one, that's like 13 sheets. That's every service offered under FERTech. A lot of it is focused on commercial frequency, food waste, mixer. I think I covered anything. Any questions on this?
I know that it's going to match $30, and it's going to match the city of Rupert, but the city of Rupert is not doing any of the admin. So shouldn't it be lower than unless they're going to be throwing in extra service that the city doesn't have? The city doesn't do any customer service for it. They don't answer phones, they don't do any of that. It goes directly to the person. We
I'm happy that we have the matching rate, but there's still some services that are provided by RCSC that is not by person.
That's a good point. What I would imagine is how Peruba Valley develops the rate. There's a component that's here that covers Vertex emissions, which I would imagine are a lot more expensive than our emissions. To me, this was a big win.
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying, but I think I get, you know, how the sausage is made is important, but at the end of the day, the customer sees one number, and then for one of you to have a conversation with somebody on the website and saying, we now pay the same rate, I think that's the thing.
That's a really big win.
Yeah.
I'm really happy to hear that.
The plus roof, I get the nuts and bolts of that one.
I would really want to see the nuts and bolts on the other side. Of the
Because they really got a sweet deal. What are they locked in for another? What did the.
They're going to run very similar to what our proposed term is, 2035.
Right, so they're going to be on the carpet, and they're not going to get that sweet.
I don't know. Rupa had a really good deal.
Yeah.
Everything I'm told is that will change for them. I don't know.
Yeah,
my focus
that's going to, that's what they use, that's their thing, but their deal is going to, their good times are not going to roll when that contract is up.
So before I move on, so 38.92, that's the new proposed rate. Again, this is the focus on the 90-gallon can. That's from 37.35. This hasn't changed in 2 years. $1.57, 4.2.
The majority of ours are 90-gallon cans, because I know on the other side of town, it's mostly the leaders.
90% of our trash customers are residential 90-gallon cans.
That is correct.
So just to highlight this a little bit more, proposed rate 38.92. I mentioned that will be identical for a 90-gallon can citywide. That's $157 per month, 4.2%. Think about it over the 2 year period since we last adjusted the rate, 79 cents per year. All right, so I want to talk a little bit more about the agency and the commercial franchise fee, right? So this is our take home portion. This is how we fund our trash enterprise to operate break even. Talk about the residential side, right? That's a specific dollar amount. For 14 years, that was 25 cents. The magnitude of that generated $9,000 a year to cover salaries in 2020. That has to change, because what we were finding out is we were having to subsidize the trash enterprise through discretionary property tax revenue. When we do that, that's great, but then that does not allow for that money to go to more operational challenges on the water. So having a finance background, at a minimum, my plan was to make trash break even. At a minimum, we don't have trash assets, we have a contract, but we cannot be subsidizing a standalone enterprise with property tax revenues, or we want to avoid it at all costs. So, we, the board at the time adopted this 5-year plan, right, taking that up to 2 years in fiscal year 26-27. We were going to hit that 2-year mark a year early, and then on the commercial franchise fee, 10% up to 17%, we were going to hit that 17% a year early. So, I can't stress this enough. Same rate, this shows up, Vertex is taking a haircut on their revenue. All right, so why it's so important, right? It generates revenue to cover the administrative and overhead costs of running the trash enterprise. Insufficient revenues, as I mentioned, require the use of discretionary property tax revenues. My goal on the trash side, at a minimum, Green even, I apologize. So the Prop 2 rate process. So that's running direction from the board.
It's break even.
So the Prop 218 process, this is different. We do standalone Prop 218s for trash. It's been very volatile. The 6 years I've been here, we've always done single year Prop 218. So in order to do the Prop 218, we need to hold a notice public hearing. The notice of public hearing must be mailed to property owners of record and tenants directly responsible for the fee at least 45 days prior to the public hearing. And then the notice has four main components that must be included: the amount of the fee, the basis on which it was calculated, the
reason for the fee and the date, time, and location of the public hearing. So there was a timeline that was discussed at the Solid Waste Committee last Thursday. What we had talked about was having this action item today and mail everything out tomorrow. If we were able to accomplish that, we could have had the public protest hearing on June 19th. Shortly after our meeting, I talked with Martha. There's processing times associated with our printing vendor that just was not feasible. So I have two options that I'll present on, and that's not the smorgasbord of options. There's other options, but I think that the goal here is to try to have these rates in effect as close to July 1 as possible. Again, these haven't been adjusted in a couple of years. Burtec has been very patient with us, so that has been the objective, at least going through my head, when presenting on these kind of options. So option one, May 1st, which is today, board considers to authorize staff to initiate the Prop 218. And no later than May 12th, we would mail the Prop 218 and post the draft resolution on the website and in the district office. And then on June 27th, we would have a special board meeting. That's a Thursday. We'd have most likely a single agenda item about the protest hearing and adopt the rate adjustment resolution. And then those would be effective July 1. So this is Burtec's preferred option. After I talked with Martha on Thursday, I sent out an email to the Solid Waste Committee letting them know kind of, you know, new circumstances, and then I talked to Burtec at the same time. This is what they prefer. But there's option two. So tonight, May 1st, board authorizes staff to initiate the Prop 218. Then we mail no later than May 19th. By doing that, we would schedule the public protest hearing July 3rd, which is the first regularly scheduled board meeting in July. And then the thing about a resolution, there's no delayed effective date. They can be effective immediately. So then July 3rd would be the effective date. Then option three.
I think option one would be accommodating towards the protest. Would like to.
This is just I've never done a special meeting before. I'll know it like the back of my hand by the time, but it would be a special meeting with one agenda item the fourth Thursday of June. Same time, 4 o'clock, June, I think, 27th.
I'm interested to know what the board members' availability is for the scheduled second meeting in the fourth week and first week. For anybody who's not available?
The first week of July is real tough for me.
Yeah, I'm going to be gone. What did you say, June? What?
So there's on the calendar, it is
there's
June 19th, June 26th, July 3rd.
Yeah, I'm available on all those days.
What was that? June 19th, June 26th, and July 3rd.
I'm not I will not be available July 3rd.
We're down. Can you zoom in?
No, I'll be in.
Oh, you're here. Going to Ireland.
Yeah.
All right. So I think it's important for the board members to be at the meeting if it's something important like race going up.
Well, I mean,
so I don't think we should have it on the 3rd of July. What are the options we have?
So it can't be June 19th. If it's not going to be July 3rd, it's either a special meeting July 26th or some other future day well into July, although I would not recommend that.
Really need to.
So
we can still make a decision down one board member.
The special meeting does not have to be that Thursday. I just, you know, for consistency, we meet on Thursdays at 4 o'clock, right? So I think there's some flexibility. I would have to change the mailing a little bit, but it can't be 19th.
So, there's the last week in June. There's a Thursday in the last week in June. That is the 26th. Are all the board members available for that?
Yeah, I'm available.
All right. June 26th? That's then. I'm
motion for staff's recommendation. Well, it was option one. The motion.
All right. I mean, we've got to accommodate or take a look.
I mean, maybe we can do the contract that time, too, if that's ready to go. So maybe two items, but
that, trash for that. There, for the contract, there are two things that have to happen. The word aggregate has to get defined or some substitute for that. We have to understand that they've got to have a rate for that. What was the other item? The contract compliance stuff, I can just get answers as to whether or not we're compliant or not compliant.
Brian, I'll get you what you need.
Let me identify the other item. The rate for the street sweep call out. So is that the 1 hour call out rate?
I don't know.
All right. So I need to understand the rate for this call out. So those are the two things that I need. It would be helpful if they had the new service map available for the protest hearing so that when people are complaining about the rates, we can say, oh, look at this benefit you're getting, but it's not essential. I don't think that we're going to have an answer on the signs. I guess it's an issue.
That's something that'll get worse.
That's how that's going to get handled. It'll take a while to get
It is the hourly rate. It's on the last page of attachment one.
All right, I'll look at that. So,
so we need a motion to. Do we make a motion for this, or we just?
So we're going to schedule a meeting for the 26th. And we're going to do the protest hearing and approve the contract. That means that we need to have a solid waste meeting sometime in the next. What's the day?
First.
It's the first. So sometime in the next 3 weeks, we got to have a solid waste meeting. I'm available. I'm available 7 days a week, any time of the day. If I can work 100 hours during COVID,
I will work with them. So I had heard Director Scribellos initially with the motion, or things have changed.
Yeah, I made a motion for
all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? So be it.
Want to make note, though, it does say June 27th.
I apologize.
So just, yeah.
Thursday, June 25th.
Jeez. Too many mistakes today, man. Anyway, director's comments. Next meeting.
I have a couple of questions I'd like to get answered by the local council also. Again, to Brian, if you could go ahead and have an email me a response.
All right. Next meeting is Thursday, May 15th at 3, right? Before we're having a budget. Our meeting starts at 4. Well, that being said,